From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Wright brothers successfully took to the air at Kitty Hawk, and that is why North Carolina lays claim to being first in flight. But it can also embrace another first, experimenting with and successfully sending the first wireless communications. Inventor Reginald Fessenden conducted those experiments and held public demonstrations of this newfangled technology on North Carolina's Outer Banks. That means radio was born here. Fessenden spent 20 months here in 1901 and 2, sending wireless telegraph signals and eventually musical notes from Hatteras Island to Roanoke Island, a distance of 50 miles. More about that this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Look at North Carolina license plates and you will see these claims. First English colony. First in freedom, first in flight. Bold claims, all true. What's missing is first in radio. But Kevin Duffus may fix that. Duffus is a research historian, documentary filmmaker, and author whose latest book uncovers enough information to make that last claim stick. In the spring of 1902, after a year of experimentation and for the first time in history, musical notes were transmitted wirelessly across 48 miles of the Pamlico Sound from Hatteras Island to Roanoke Island. That first was accomplished by Reginald Fessenden, a protege of Thomas Edison. In his book about this milestone, Kevin Duffus not only uncovers some previously unknown facts, he corrects the historical record. The book is called The Inventor Reginald Fessenden and the Origins of American Radio on North Carolina's Outer Banks. And Kevin Duffus joins us for the hour. He's been here many times before. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Great. I'm happy to be back, Mike.
As I said, you've been here I don't know how many times. Do you know how many times?
Well, I was afraid to say how many times because I don't know if there's a limit to how many times you're allowed on the show. But this might be seven or eight.
Okay, the beast must be fed. But you've written about and corrected the historical record on Blackbeard the Pirate. You were here to talk about World War II and how close the Nazi war effort came to North Carolina in the 40s. You've also written about shipwrecks off the Outer Banks. You were here to talk about your research into the mystery of the missing Fresnel lens that was housed in the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. You're also a former broadcaster, yet you got around to writing, finally, about Reginald Fessenden. What took you so long?
Well, for many years, I've passed a historical marker as you approach the village of Buxton in Cape Hatteras that is titled Radio Milestone, and it mentions the fact that from that spot, musical notes had been transmitted for the first time in 1902, and I never paid much more attention to that, but about 3 years ago, I was contacted by the executive director of the North Carolina Broadcast History Project, which is an organization of broadcasters who want to promote the early history of North Carolina broadcasting. And they asked me to research and write a television documentary about the life of Reginald Fessenden. And I warned them, you might not be too pleased with what I might discover, because it has been my habit and my experience that every time I research a subject, I discovered dozens and dozens of pieces of misinformation and misconceptions about our past. And that certainly turned out to be the case with Reginald Fessenden.
Which we'll get into as we go through this. If I got this right, you started out as a cameraman on the floor of a television station, a local television station, and you've become a documentarian. You've written how many books now?
11, this is the Fessenden book is my eighth book, but I have two in the wings, so it'll end up being 10.
But they're all kind of based on history. So how did you go from being a cameraman to an historian?
Well, I always loved history and going back to high school, and my family moved to Eastern North Carolina in the late 60s, and I started reading local histories and discovered, of course, that the pirate Blackbeard had been there. And I probably one of the greatest things that influenced me was a September 1969 issue of National Geographic, which featured the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And accompanying that magazine that month was the ubiquitous map of shipwrecks. It's titled Ghost Fleet of the Outer Banks. I think probably everybody's seen it if they don't remember it. But every tiny place on the Outer Banks is marked with a symbol of a shipwreck.
Okay.
And that absolutely just captured my attention. In fact, I was so fascinated by the Outer Banks that when I was 17, I asked my dad if I could drive to the Outer Banks because I wanted to see the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. I wanted to go to Ocracoke Island where Blackbeard was killed. He wouldn't let me take the family car. He thought that was too far to go. I didn't have enough experience driving. So I convinced him to let me ride my bicycle out there. So that's, in fact, what I did. It took 2.5 days in August of 1971. I did reach the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse and then went to Ocracoke. And I had rode up to this community store at Ocracoke. I wanted to see the place. I had seen the movie Blackbeard's Ghost with Peter Ustinov, the Disney movie. Blackbeard in the movie, of course, built his hotel on this 100-foot-high cliff overlooking the bay where he had captured his victims' ships. And so I pulled up to this community store. There were three old-timers in rocking chairs, and I asked them, I said, could you tell me where that 100-foot-high rocky cliff is overlooking the bay where Blackbeard built his hotel? And they started laughing, and one of them with his hoi-toid brogue accent said, "Son, you come to the wrong place." He said, "The highest place on this island is 8 feet." And that's when I learned not to get my history from movies. But ever since, I've been absolutely fascinated with the maritime history.
Well, this book about Reginald Fessenden is not a biography, although we learn a lot about him, we learn a lot about his life. Talk to me about, because a lot of people have never heard his name, who was he and what in his background led to his interest in and development of what was then called, what was it called, wireless telephony or
telephony?
Telephony.
Wireless
which
telephony.
Which became known as radio.
Which is what we're doing right now.
Right,
this
exactly.
is wireless telephony.
Well, this is why this is interesting, because every single thing in our modern life stems from this guy, which we will talk about. His invention has impacted everything.
And few people know anything about it or
it's
know
astounding.
About him. He was born in Canada, about 10 miles north of the Vermont border. His father was an American Anglican minister, and they were transferred around a few times. But even from in his very early years, it was recognized by his parents that he had this insatiable desire to help people and also to create things that would help people. And he was a brilliant young man, was actually teaching mathematics to college students when he was 14 years old.
And didn't have a college degree.
And he never had a college
yes.
degree. He actually became professor of engineering, electrical engineering at both Purdue and Western University, which is now the University of Pittsburgh. So, yes, he was quite brilliant. He, between the ages of 19 and 21, he was the headmaster of a middle school in Bermuda. And at Bermuda, on the day that he arrived, which is an important part of my book, I discovered that he, on the same day, he saw the house that he would eventually buy once he, at the end of his life, he would pass or visit the cemetery where he would someday be buried. But the most important thing on that day was he met this 19-year-old woman who became his one and only love of his life, mm-hmm. and Helen Trott, who was a descendant of the original Bermuda settlers. And they eventually married. But what Fessenden wanted, he didn't want to teach middle school. He wanted to be an electrical engineer. And so he left Bermuda, went to New York, and sat down and wrote a letter to Thomas Edison asking for employment. And then he said, "I'm going to come see you."
Yeah.
And he did.
He was, what's the word I'm looking for? He wouldn't let it go. He was like a dog with a bone.
He was irrepressible.
Because Thomas Jefferson turned, Thomas Jefferson turned him down too. But Thomas Edison turned him down numerous times, and he just wouldn't let the bone go.
He wouldn't. In fact, the day he just showed up without an appointment at Edison's, now you got me saying Jefferson, Edison, Edison's office, and sent a note in saying, I would like for you to give me a job, and Edison wrote back. He never left his office. He sent a note out saying, well, what do you know about electricity? And Fessenden sent another note back in saying, I don't know, but I learned pretty quick. And Edison then sent a note back saying, well, I got plenty of people here that don't know anything about electricity. Go away.
Well, this is in the late 1800s. Nobody knew anything about electricity, did they? Weren't they all learning it together?
Well, Edison, that was kind of a joke on Edison's part, because he had enough people there that knew about electricity, because he was in the middle of inventing the phonograph, and he had already invented the electric light bulb. But
he wanted to be in the Edison labs in New Jersey because he wanted to learn, I guess, at the foot of the master to become an electrical engineer. But when he was hired, they put him in the chemistry department?
Well, Edison was mad at his chief chemist at the time, and so he just made this 21-year-old Fessenden a chemist, and then he promoted him to chief chemist. But what Fessenden learned from working, and Edison worked his people like dogs. I mean, they were working 60 hours a week for little pay, but they learned the Edison process. And there's a great moment in the book where Fessenden comes to Edison and says, "Okay, I've solved this problem. I've tested 400 different chemicals, and I have found the one that works." And Edison said, "Well, I guess you better get some more beakers because you're not done testing." Because Edison believed in testing every possible solution to a problem. And later, when Fessenden got into wireless experiments, that's what served him so well, was that he left no stone unturned. And in a way, it's kind of, I parallel all of this with my research. When I research a subject, I almost don't know when to quit, because you've got to learn everything you can possibly learn about something subject.
Kevin Duffus is with us. He's an author, historian, and his latest book is about the man who is responsible for everything.
I don't know whether we should honor him or not.
I'm not, and we'll talk about what that means, everything, as we go through this hour, because it's not just the beginnings of radio in North America on the Outer Banks. It's everything. We'll talk about that as we go through, as I said, through the hour here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. This Edison method not only includes exhaustive research, it includes exhaustion, because there are photographs, and I think one is in your book, of Thomas Edison sleeping on the floor of his research laboratory, because they worked all the time. And that's something that Reginald Fessenden took with him to the Outer Banks, because he writes to friends about being exhausted to the point where he couldn't see straight. And so he slept for 2 days, and now he's better. He's ready to go back at it. But that's how he approached the inventions of radio.
Yes, and it's pretty remarkable to think about. I've described Fessenden as being the sort of the very typical Shakespearean tragic hero. Mm-hmm. He had such potential, but at the same time, there was so much adversity in his life, and so many difficulties and frustrations. And he had business partners who stabbed him in the back and betrayed him. He had to fight major corporations like RCA and AT&T, who had essentially stolen all of his patents. It's really a fascinating story. But yes, on the Outer Banks, he came to the coast of North Carolina in 1901. He was what was called a special agent for the U.S. Weather Bureau. They contracted with him to develop a method of transmitting weather information by wireless telegraph. That was his assignment, was telegraph, not telephony or voice over the air. And And the reason was that every time there was a hurricane or storm, it blew down all of the telegraph wires, and the Weather Bureau had no way of communicating. And so wireless was a great opportunity. And in the meantime, of course, we have the Italian, Irish-Italian Marconi, who had also gotten into wireless telegraphy and was making a lot of progress on the other side of the Atlantic. But Fessenden came up with a concept that would change the direction of wireless technology.
Which we'll get into, because he thought Marconi's technology was a dead end, to use, I think, your words. Our guest today, Kevin Duffus. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Kevin Duffus. He's an author. He's a documentarian. He's an historian. He's a broadcaster. Once a broadcaster, always a broadcaster. His latest book about North Carolina history is about the inventor Reginald Fessenden. You may not know his name, but I think almost anybody of a certain age in radio or television knows Fessenden's name, but the average person does not. And we can blame that on Marconi. Marconi, he's immortalized in the movie Titanic and in the Broadway show Titanic, because it was Marconi's telegraph that allowed them to get the SOS out to the Carpathia to rescue the passengers that survived. He began experimenting with what was then called wireless communication, which became radio, in 1894 in Italy. And by 1895, Marconi had been successful in sending telegraph signals wirelessly over the air, over increasing distances. And you chronicle the work of the other guy working on this, on the other side of the Atlantic, Reginald Fessenden, who started years later, 1901, and had a similar accomplishment in 1901 and 1902. You say he is recognized as many as the father of radio, yet we don't know his name. Would it be more accurate to say that he is the father of terrestrial North American radio?
Well, I would say, you know, certainly maybe world radio, because what Marconi was doing was he was transmitting dots and dashes of Morse code, mm-hmm. using an electric spark to produce a buzz over the airwaves.
Okay.
And so the buzzes, it would be long buzzes and short buzzes, and that's basically was the wireless telegraph. Fessenden realized that that was a very limiting technology. In fact, I wrote that it was headed to a technological dead end, because Fessenden thought, well, why can't we transmit the human voice over the airwaves? But an electric spark was not fast enough to be able to accomplish that.
This gets really technical, and I hope that we don't bore people with this, but what he was doing, Fessenden, was like creating static. Is that right? Static, well, on a frequency, whereas Fessenden decided to use the carrier wave to carry information that was then amplified. Amplitude modulation is, I'm simplifying this, but amplitude modulation, AM radio.
AM radio, exactly. Well, the brilliant aspect of Fessenden's research is that he realized that there needed to be a continuous mm-hmm. electromagnetic wave through the air, not the herky-jerky dots and dashes of Morse code or the Marconi system. But to do that, he needed something that would generate those electromagnetic waves at a rate high enough to be able to carry those signals. So he needed a generator or an alternator to be able to produce that, but one didn't exist at the time. So he put in an order to General Electric asking them to build this machine that could generate 50,000 cycles a second, which was unheard of. In fact, they said that was impossible. But in the meantime, so Fessenden was a professor of electrical engineering at the Western University, which was Pitt. And he was then contracted by the government, the U.S. Weather Bureau, to become to work on sending wireless telegraph signals for the weather service, sending hurricane warnings and also weather information. And so he eventually ended up on the coast of North Carolina. They needed a place where he could send signals over water uninterrupted for a distance of 50 miles or so. And really the only place that afforded all of the things that they needed to accomplish that was the Outer Banks of North Carolina. So he established a receiver station on Roanoke Island at the northwest corner of Roanoke Island, ironically just a mile from the birthplace of English America. And also in 1901,
and
by the
way— 7 miles from Kitty Hawk.
Kill Devil Hills. 7 miles where the Wright brothers were conducting their glider experiments. They had not gotten into the powered flight during those years that Fessenden, they were both there at the same time. And ask me, you know, it's often been said that they became great friends and drank beer together at the end of the day, you know, and I've proven that that absolutely is not true. So Fessenden set up a second station down on Hatteras Island. And so they began conducting using the Marconi system, because again, Fessenden had not yet been able to get the generator that he needed. And so they began sending telegraphic signals across the Pamlico Sound, and they were reasonably successful at doing that.
You pinpoint a date, and this is all taking place on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. You pinpoint April 26th, 1902. Specifically Weir's Point on the northwest shore of Roanoke Island as the birthplace and the birthday of American radio. What were the original signals that he sent and received in front of a live audience? We'll talk about the stakes of all this in a minute, but what did he send? What message did he send?
Well, the message actually was sent from Hatteras Island up to Weir's Point. So it was transmitted from, and we also want to talk about where that location is, because that's one of the most provocative, controversial discoveries that I've made.
Right.
But the message was, it actually, the chief of the U.S. Weather Bureau in Washington, D.C., wanted to send a message to Fessenden, and he telegraphed it down to from Washington to Norfolk and then down through all the life-saving stations until it eventually reached the weather station on Hatteras Island. And then they retransmitted that message over the air from Hatteras to Roanoke Island. And it was a 127-word message, and Willis Moore, the chief of the Weather Bureau, was saying, make sure that you welcome your dignitaries, because there were a number of special guests who attended that day as witnesses. And that essentially was the message. The next day, by the way, as far away as San Francisco, this event was reported in the newspaper. It was banner headlines.
How did they know about it?
By telegraph. The New York Times was present. The New York Times had a correspondent at Roanoke Island, and they reported on this story. And, of course, it was amazing how fast, you know, newspapers would get news back then. But it was still just by telegraph, Morse code messages.
This was in 1902. It was 18 years later that radio, as we know it today, would be born. In Charlotte, December 1920, when Fred Laxton, Earl Gluck, and Fred Bunker set up an amateur radio setup at Laxton's home. They used the wire on the backyard chicken coop as their antenna. That became experimental station 4XD, which several years later, in 1922, would become WBT. So they started in a chicken coop. What was Fessenden's setup like?
Well, fortunately, the Fessenden setup was described in the Raleigh News and Observer. I found an article from 1902 that reasonably accurately described his setup. But it was his receiver building was a 6-foot by 10-foot board and batten shack. In fact, I've called it the original radio shack, And he had a tower that was 140 feet tall. It was three 60-foot poles that were overlapped, and it was very spindly and precarious looking, but that was his receiver tower.
And you report that some of the inaccuracies that you've discovered along the way is that there are photographs of this in historical locations, but they aren't the photographs of his setup on Hatteras or on Roanoke Island. They are in Virginia. Why?
Correct. Well, for whatever reason, and Fessenden was equipped with a camera, and but I was the North Carolina State Archives contains actually the most of Fessenden's private papers. In fact, his son, after Fessenden's death in 1932, his son in 1941 donated all of Fessenden's archival material to the State Archives of North Carolina, and I can explain why. But and so I've poured through their 190 boxes of material in Raleigh, and I was never able to find a single photograph of any of his facilities while he was in North Carolina.
Huh.
There's one photograph that I've published in the book that had never been published before of Fessenden standing on the shoreline, which I believe was on Hatteras Island, that is in the collections of the University of Pittsburgh archives. And but the state of North Carolina has been using photos from Virginia to depict Fessenden's facility on Roanoke Island. And I was astounded to discover that they purposely cropped out Fessenden's own very distinctive handwritten date, which would have proven that the photograph was in Virginia, not in North Carolina. But that is just one, that's the tip of the iceberg of all the things that I discovered that are wrong with the Fessenden.
One of the things that you seem to have a facility for is uncovering mistakes in the historical record, not just in this book, but in all of the books that you have written. And I'm curious as to why. Why, how is it that things that we take as gospel in many cases are simply not true? They're made up.
Well, there are many reasons, and there have been historians that will invent things to fill gaps in stories. I know of, in Fessenden's case, there were a couple writers who actually invented dialogue and invented events and scenes simply to fill the pages of a book. And yeah, I started out when I had to research this book. The first thing I did was I collected and read every single book I could find on electromagnetic radiation and the early history of radio and so forth. And then everything I could find on Fessenden. And one of the first things I realized was there were so many contradictions or so many different interpretations of what happened. For example, simply we mentioned the 127 word message that was sent from Hatteras to Roanoke Island in April 26, 1902. One government institution says that that was a telegraph message, and another government institution, the federal government, says that it was a voice message. So you come across these two facts or questions, and you have to figure out and then distill the source information to figure out where is the historical truth. And so that's maybe what I find most fascinating about history. I think I enjoy that more than anything, is searching for the truth of history, because it's not always right there on the page.
One of the mistakes that you uncovered is on the front cover of your book, and that is the historical road marker that's down there, which claims that his wireless station on Hatteras Island was located near Buxton. Not true. What is true, and why has that claim been made and then found its way into other on government websites and books and papers, etc.? Why was that claim made in the first place?
I'll start by asking you a question, I think, and also the listeners. You know, have you ever been to the Wright Memorial at Killdevil Hills?
No.
Okay, well, I'm sure many of his listeners have. Everyone sort of sees the big monument that's up on the hill, but there is a granite boulder which marks the very spot where the Wright brothers' first powered flight took off from. That location was actually determined by three of the witnesses that were there for the 25th anniversary in 1928. That's when that granite boulder was placed. Can you imagine if that wasn't there? Can you imagine if nobody knew exactly where, couldn't remember where that first flight, it would be a travesty. So I mentioned this historical marker that's just outside the village of Buxton, radio milestone from near here in 1902. Well, one of the things I discovered in researching the Fessenden story is not a single time does in any of Fessenden's papers, in his biography written by his wife, but in the notebooks that were compiled by his assistant, who was based at Hatteras Island, never once did they say that his radio transmitter site was in Buxton. And more I researched this, I came to the conclusion, which I can now verify, that his radio transmitter was actually in the village of Hatteras, which is about 11 miles further down Highway 12 from where this historical marker is located. And since then, of course, since I published the book last fall, I have now pinpointed the exact location of where I believe that those towers were. He had two 150-foot tall towers that he was using, and this is also a very key moment in the book. He went beyond his contract with the Weather Bureau, which was only to develop and perfect telegraphic Morse code wireless signals.
Mm-hmm.
He was already thinking about combining the human voice or music with a carrier wave, which was in fact the origins of American radio, and that's why he had these two towers at Hatteras. That's how he was able to transmit what he called musical notes from Hatteras Village. But at Hatteras Village, I was just there a month ago, and I presented this lecture, and not a single person there knows anything about it.
I want to talk about the musical notes a little bit later, but now that you've uncovered that this road marker is incorrect, is it going to be changed?
I honestly don't know. I've heard nothing but silence from the historical community.
Radio silence.
Radio silence.
Kevin Duffus is our guest. His book is called The Inventor, Reginald Fessenden and the Origins of American Radio on North Carolina's Outer Banks on WFAE here this morning on Charlotte Talks. He conducted these experiments in wireless communication on the Outer Banks. He held public demonstrations there. And the Outer Banks, if it's remote today, it must have really been remote in 1901. I mean, how did you even get there? Seriously.
Well, I mean, to answer that question very quickly, you usually would travel. You could travel by train to Elizabeth City, but from there, you would have to book a ride on an old schooner. In the book, I tell this very funny story about Wilbur Wright. He was on his way for his first time to go out to Kill Devil Hills for their glider experiments. This was, I think, in 1901. He had just missed Fessenden by 3 weeks in Elizabeth City. But Wilbur arrives, and he can't find anybody in Elizabeth City who even knows where Kitty Hawk or Kill Devil Hills is or never heard, you know. And then he eventually hires this schooner captain, who has this old leaky schooner, and Wilbur was so disgusted with the poor conditions that he wouldn't even go below in the cabin. And it's an interesting story. They went in a storm. They barely made it. They almost sank. So the Outer Banks was very, very remote, and it was a sort of this desolate, yeah, sandy area.
You print one of his colleagues at the Washington, D.C. Weather Bureau writing a letter to him saying, quote, "It seems to me as though you had gone off into the dark, as though you were banished from the world, as though you had gone into the woods to solve your problems, or as though you had struck a whale and gone under." But there was a hotel.
There was. Actually, Manio, the village of Manio was fairly sophisticated, and there were these beach hotels out at Nag's Head. One of my other favorite quotes comes from Fessenden's best friend, this man named Arthur Kennelly, who was a brilliant mathematician and was the co-discoverer of the ionosphere, which, by the way, made radio transmissions possible at night. He came to visit Fessenden for Thanksgiving in 1901, and when he went back, he sent him a thank you note and said, "I enjoyed my Robinson Crusoe experience."
It was rough.
Yes.
Kevin Duffus, our guest. Reginald Fessenden is the man we're talking about, and we'll tell you about what else he did and how he transmitted those first musical notes on radio. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Kevin Duffus, the author of many books about North Carolina history, uncovering truths heretofore unknown, and correcting the historical record. And his latest accomplishment is The Inventor, Reginald Fessenden, and the Origins of American Radio on North Carolina's Outer Banks. So it began here. KDKA might be the first commercially licensed stations in the country, but it started here. And you point, as I said earlier, to April 26, 1902 in Manteo as the day that American radio was born. It was the day that dignitaries came to witness this experiment. I think the president of the National Geographic Association was there, or a society was there. A Coast Guard superintendent was there. The New York Times was there. Thomas Edison's two sons, William and Tom Jr., were there. But Fessenden had conducted these experiments prior to that day. A lot was riding on this day because he had witnesses, but he had conducted experiments prior to that day. So why do you pinpoint that day as the birth?
Well, it's for an inventor like Fessenden, I mean, it's important to eventually demonstrate what you've created, what you've invented, and to prove that it actually works. And, you know, he learned that from Edison, by the way. And so, but there's also a great risk in doing that, because there could have been all sorts of problems that would have been an embarrassment had it not worked. In fact, that actually happened. I described an instance where that happened with Edison, where he was demonstrating his phonograph to a group of very prominent investors. What he didn't know was 15 minutes before they came into the room, his assistant had changed something with the phonograph. And so when he demonstrated it, it didn't work at all. And it was very embarrassing. And the investors promised to come back, but they never did. And so on April 26, of course, Fessenden was ready. He was getting a lot of pressure from his boss, who was the chief of the U.S. Weather Bureau, to show something that, you know, to justify his contract. And so he scheduled this public demonstration. All of these dignitaries arrived in Manio, and they had to travel by ox and horse-drawn cart 4 miles out to Weir's Point. As I write, I mean, little would they have known that it was such a desolate wilderness that they had to travel through, but little would they have known that 200 years earlier that there was a place called the City of Raleigh. It was 107 Elizabethan soldiers were occupied a town called the City of Raleigh for almost a year in 1585. But anyway, Fessenden had planned this, and at 10 a.m., his assistant out down in the village of Hatteras was supposed to send a signal that would ring a bell in his radio shack at Weir's Point on the west coast of Roanoke Island. And I'm sure I always try to put myself in the mind of the people that I write about, but I'm sure Fessenden was very anxious and pacing and was watching his stopwatch. And this was supposed to happen exactly at 10 o'clock. And sure enough, at 10 o'clock, a bell rang that was activated by this transmitter in Hatteras, and then all of a sudden the telegraph started clacking, clicking and clacking. And
They didn't have speakers back then, so how did all these dignitaries hear?
With headphones, telephone, you know, so they did have telephone headphones and earpieces and microphones. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as the bell rang, telegraphist at the receiving end at Roanoke Island put on his headphones and began to write out the message, you know, because telegraphists could read Morse code,
right,
and write it out very quickly. And they said, it's, you know, we're receiving a message from Hatteras. 15 minutes later is when this 127-word message arrived that originated from Washington, D.C. just a couple of minutes earlier. And this was what a miracle. I mean, Imagine what people were thinking. And it's like, that now it's come by air, and it was revolutionary. And and as I said, the very next day in the New York Times, the San Francisco Examiner, banner headlines, you know, Fessenden transmits 127-word message. I mean, this is and they didn't realize that this was the dawn or the birth of radio. They didn't know, radio wasn't even a word used at that time.
You have said that the demonstration, if successful, would fulfill his government contract. It would increase the value of his past and future U.S. patents. And most important of all, it would assure his standing in the pantheon of great inventors of his time. And there were you couldn't hit a bush without hitting an inventor at that time. There were so many: Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, Fessenden, other people of that time. Why was there such a collective group of people making groundbreaking discoveries in that?
Well, I mean, I've described it as the golden age of invention. I mean, it's the industrial age, the Victorian era, but there was something about that particular time where technology was making leaps and bounds, probably like in our own lifetime since the 1990s and with the birth of the internet and all of the technology that has now entered our lives just in the last 20 years.
But do we know if it increased his stature? We don't know his name. Did it increase his stature? Because he was successful.
He was reasonably well known. But a couple strange things about Fessenden, and as I said, he's a tragic hero in the Shakespearean sense. But one of his faults was that he tended to be somewhat secretive about his technological developments and inventions. And so, like, for in the case of the musical notes, the only reason why we know that he transmitted musical notes from Hatteras to Roanoke Island is that his wife in 1940 published a letter that he had written to his patent attorney in Pittsburgh mentioning that he had successfully transmitted musical notes. But it was – so that was 38 years later, and Fessenden never said and during his lifetime, I transmitted musical notes.
Why? He did that, I think you say, 3 weeks before this demonstration that you pinpoint as the birth of radio. But he transmitted these musical notes, and as you say, we only know that because of the book that his wife wrote about him after he died in 1940. Why?
It's just I've not been able to figure that out, except it was just one of his fatal flaws. He might – well, one reason, and I speculated this in the book, is that that was not part of his contract. And so he would have gotten into some difficulty with the Weather Service and the Department of Agriculture, who he was working for having spent time working on something that he was not contracted to do, which is telephony, not telegraphy.
So how did he create those musical notes, and how did he transmit them? I mean, what was there an instrument involved? Was it just tones? What was it?
Well, it was in fact just tones.
Okay.
In his letter to his patent attorney, which again was not made public until 38 years later, he called them musical notes. But I had to research. Did he sit there with a clarinet or a violin and play musical notes over a microphone? And the fact is that I believe the tones were actually – there was a device invented by Alexander Graham Bell's competitor, a man named Elisha Gray, who came within something like 5 minutes of filing a patent for the telephone at the patent office, but Bell's representative got there first. But Elisha Gray invented this electromagnetic device that looked like a little tiny keyboard that would generate tones that could then be sent over a telegraph wire because they were, you know, he was experimenting with that. And so Fessenden refers to that in one of his patents, the Elisha Gray harmonic generator. And so that may have been one way he transmitted the tones. But then I found in another patent that he actually drew tuning forks. And that may have been the other way that he generated those musical notes. He called them musical notes. I call them tones.
So that was the first synthesizer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. You say that the number of documents related directly to his experiments on the Outer Banks in 1901 and 2 are relatively few. He was an inventor. He had a secretary or an assistant who wrote everything down. Why? Why do we have these documents?
Well, I was never able to actually locate his own personal journal or diary, and it may not be in any archive. It was not donated to the North Carolina State Archives. But I was able to handle the original daily journal of his assistant, a man named Albert Thiessen, who and I learned so much from the pages of that journal. But even that journal is incomplete. But yes, when I was given this task to research Reginald Fessenden by the North Carolina Broadcast History Project, I went to the state archives and they said, we have 190 boxes of material. Well, there are only probably two boxes out of those 190 that have anything to do with his work on the coast of North Carolina. But I was able to, I eventually amassed a file of over 1,900 sources of information that I used to compile this book. So I was able to find information from, newspaper accounts from the time, again, the Albert Thiessen Journal, Helen Fessenden's biography of her husband, although it's, naturally biased toward her husband, and rightly so, because he really deserves so much credit. There are a number of times that people on the coast of North Carolina have tried to establish a memorial to Fessenden. And hopefully the day will come when that will in fact happen. But Helen Fessenden's biography was a good source. But I can't explain why he didn't write this down. I mean, we have copies of letters that he wrote, many to his patent attorney, And the patents themselves were also a good source of information.
I mentioned earlier that the reason this man is important is not just because he transmitted the first wireless telegraph signals using a new technology and the first musical notes, and it was the birth of AM radio in North America. But AM radio gave way to FM radio. AM was the signal in the analog days that they used to transmit the picture for television. FM was the sound. Is that right? Did I have it?
That's correct. No, that's...
And then it is the antecedent to everything. Cell phones, satellite transmissions, GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, the remote control you use to change channels on television, everything.
Well, it's important to point out that there are three things that Fessenden should be remembered for. And not I've written that the musical notes transmission, it's important, it's mm-hmm. significant, but it's not the most important thing he should be remembered for. He invented heterodyne theory, okay? Heterodyne, which is the combining of multiple signals, a carrier wave, another electromagnetic wave carrying a voice or music. That is the foundation of broadcasting. And also, he was the one who conceived a continuous wave of electromagnetic radiation. If we didn't have that, you know, we'd still have the Marconi dots and dashes, and that
right.
would be it.
That would be it.
And then amplitude modulation, the ability to be able to modulate two signals and then extract them at a receiver. That is, again, the foundation of American radio.
So why isn't he as well known as Alexander Graham Bell or Thomas Edison or even Marconi, whose technology has fallen by the wayside? Why?
Well, part of the blame falls on him. You know, he wasn't. So Marconi was an entrepreneur. He was an inventor and an entrepreneur. Fessenden was a scientist, a mathematician. He was most comfortable in a university laboratory, and he had to learn how to talk about himself and promote himself, but he was never quite as good at it. He also, his personality, if you might remember, very difficult. He was irascible and combative, and I would have to say that most of the men who worked for him found him extremely difficult to work for. One of his fatal flaws was his personality.
Yeah, you say the demonstration of, no, excuse me, you said he's stormy and colorful, irritable, demanding, vain, pompous, irascible, combative, domineering, had little patience for listeners who failed to comprehend what he was talking about, which at that time would be almost everybody.
Right, exactly. But other than that, he was a great guy. the other thing I want to point out about him in describing him is that, and I really got a laugh out of this, I found his 1914 U.S. passport, and it described his physical features. One of the things it noted was that it said his forehead was massive. And I say that his forehead was actually, no pun intended, the butt of many jokes among his friends. And his good friend Kennelly even addressed him in a letter saying, "My dear fellow with the forehead."
Kevin Duffus is our guest. His book is about Reginald Fessenden, the inventor and the of American radio on the Outer Banks of North Carolina on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. His work on wireless transmission wasn't just about radio. He made other inventions along the way later on. He found a use, you say, for X-rays to find defects in the armor plating of warships. He developed a depth finder, rather, that was used during World War I, based on the same technology?
He invented the depth finder. So every boat that goes out today that has a depth finder, those boaters can thank Reginald Fessenden for their ability to know how deep the water is.
I mean, it is said that who invented Facebook? I can't think of his name. Who invented Facebook?
That's debatable.
Turn your mic on, Chris. Turn it on.
Mark Zuckerberg.
Thank you, Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, there are a couple other people. What is it? Those twins might dispute that.
That's right. They dispute that. And then you have all these people fighting for patents at that time. You have it's not just Reginald Fessenden. It's the guy who invented FM radio. It's the guy who invented television. You don't know their names either. And their patents were stolen by big companies like General Electric and Westinghouse and the Radio Corporation of America, et cetera, RCA. How did that all happen? Why aren't these guys getting their due?
Well, maybe there are not enough historians like myself who are out there trying to tell the truth about these people. And hopefully the day will come where there will be some sort of monument or memorial other than what has been sort of derisively called history on a stick. That's what they call these historical markers, history on a stick. Hopefully Fessenden will get something more than that.
So I have 30 seconds. Now that you know everything there is to know about, or more than anybody else knows about Reginald Fessenden, what should his legacy be? How should we remember him?
Well, we should remember him, again, for every example of wireless technology that we have in our lives. I mean, he is responsible for it.
Remember the name. Reginald Fessenden, the inventor Reginald Fessenden and the origins of American radio on North Carolina's Outer Banks. It all started here, and it wasn't a 5,000-watt radio station. Our guest today, Kevin Duffus. Thanks again for coming back. Thanks for the hour.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Additional production assistance by Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.